Welcome to another edition of Power Talk, our interview portion. We're here in Tiburon, California, above San Francisco, and I'm really excited tonight to share with you an incredible couple, two people that are going to share with us a great deal about this thing called love, the thing that we most value in life, that most of us chase so much rather than come from the place of, and how love can really heal our relationships, how it can really heal our physical body, and how we can really maybe even enjoy a whole lot more of our life through that experience of love as an ongoing way of living rather than something, again, that we chase. And the two people I'm going to be have the privilege of introducing are Dr. Jerry Jampolsky, who you're probably very familiar with. If you're not, you soon will be. Jerry wrote a book that's pretty famous, millions of copies in print, called Love is Letting Go of Fear, and nine other books since then. He's a very famous psychiatrist who lectures around the world and really shares with people what it really takes to heal. He's also the founder of the Center for Attitudinal Healing, and with him is his partner and his partner in life, Diane Cerencioni, who also works at the center, and she works in a whole variety of areas. She's very strong within her corporate background before she met Jerry, and they developed a relationship. And currently, she works in helping people with AIDS. She's the founder of the Women in Transition Seminars, and really has trained people cross-culturally around the world in fundamentals for really making their life work. I just want to start just by thanking you both for being here and taking the time. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Tony.
One of the books is Love is the Answer. Those of you who are not familiar with them, probably the most famous book and the founding book of your philosophy is Love is Letting Go of Fear. And my wife read that book many years ago, and it really made a major difference in her life, and she was excited for us to get a chance to meet you guys. And I read it just recently and found the message to be, I think, the most important message of all. And I'd like to start out, before we talk about the message, talk about both of you so people have some background on you. And maybe starting with you, Jerry, if we may, you were extremely successful, still are, but extremely successful psychiatrist. You had started out in, I think, 1945, really, with your education, working with other people. And back in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s, you went through some major challenges. I understand you had some challenges with alcohol and in relationships. Maybe you could share with us where you were and what really turned you around.
Well, I came from a belief system of my parents that said, yesterday is awful, today's horrendous, and tomorrow's going to be worse.
How exciting.
So it becomes very difficult to experience too much joy. But they were really martyrs. Their purpose in life was to really have their three kids have an education, right, have things that they didn't. And I had dyslexia, and I wasn't able to learn to read. Right. And so I felt love was dependent on being able to please people, and that didn't work very much.
Right.
But somehow I managed to get through medical school and went into practice and made a lot of money. All the things my parents wanted me to do. But I ended up really feeling a sense of emptiness inside. I really didn't know what that was all about till many years later in meeting Mother Teresa when she talked about spiritual deprivation. That was what I was suffering from. Wow. And a 20-year marriage went sour, and I turned to alcohol. And I was really in crises, and I was a militant atheist at the time. Although my background very early had been a very religious one. What happened to me was I came across some books called A Course in Miracles that I never heard about before. I didn't even like the name. And just reading one page, I had a most unusual experience that I heard a little voice inside saying, physician, heal yourself. This is your way home. And that really began to change my life, because here was a way out of my dilemma, where you could live one day at a time having peace of mind as your only goal. Forgiveness was a real function, and learning to listen to the voice of your heart, living in a consciousness of giving, where I was really pretty much involved in myself first, wanting everything myself, and was really involved in getting rather than giving.
Did what turned you around? Was it having just so much pain that you had to find something new? What was the trigger?
For me, I was still going down. I was being stopped by the police. My medical license was in jeopardy, and that still didn't turn me around. It was really the Course in Miracles. I began doing those daily lessons, and shortly thereafter, I was at University of California Medical Center, and a little kid on rounds was saying, what's it like to die? And the oncologist didn't answer the question, changed the subject. And all of a sudden, I got some guidance that maybe these kids need some help helping each other. And I started the Center of Attitude and Healing back in 75. And that really started on me, because these young kids started to help me look at life differently, look at death differently, and made me feel that I was lovable. Most of the time, I was very afraid of relationships and didn't think I was lovable. I was really scared of intimacy.
And then along came Diane. She straightened that up.
That was much later.
Okay.
We've known each other about 10 years now, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, Diane, I'd like to hear a little bit of your background now. A lot of people have to go through tremendous pain before they create changes in their life that really work. Did you have to go that path, or did you go a smoother path in your own life?
No, I think I went through pain like everyone else, Tony. Mine wasn't in the spiritual realm, though. I've been pretty comfortable with that since I first came here. But mine's been more in the personal development. As a woman, a woman born in one generation and really during changing times, where we were told that life was to be one way, and then we got there and we said, wait a minute, this package isn't what it's pegged up to be. And I really went through lots of changes, finding out who I was in the business world, 10 years in the corporate world, and 14 years now having my own businesses, three of them, and I still currently have one. And I think that journey has been a real powerful one for me, because it's, of course, it's not just the journey of a woman, it's always the journey of men and women together, and how we see ourselves, the changing roles. And the role models really started to fall away one by one. And as an individual, I felt that I really actually had to continue to, you know, create my own. And when Jerry and I came together in a relationship, we found also that the old models didn't work for us anymore. Both of us had been married once before, and both had been divorced for 17 years. And we really feel that there was a lot of healing that had to happen. We never had remarrying as a goal, although we did that this last year. But it was only after we had, thank you, it was only really after we had been able to look at relationships in a totally new way. So Love is the Answer is really a journey of looking at relationships from a brand new perspective, and hopefully helping others to free up, to look at their own relationships and create what they really, really want in their life, what you really share with people in all of your work, to do it in a very deep personal way, in the intimate way, and to no longer really sell out because we're so afraid. In order to do that, though, we have to really look at our fears, look at the things that have caused us trauma and pain over the years, look at our unhealed relationships.
I agree. Well, one of the seminars I do that I think you're familiar with, at the end of it, we have people do something very physical to convince their belief systems that their fears are usually false evidence that appears somewhat real. Let's talk about what is real. And I think what really is real that we both share in common as a belief is love, that love is really the essence of life and connection. I'd like to hear from you. What is love? What is it really? And what prevents us from really just experiencing this natural reality all the time? What blocks us?
Well, I think we have egos that have a little message that says, seek but don't find what you're looking for. And we're out there still trying to think that it's going to be out there, and whenever we get that, it doesn't kind of work. You know, we're out there trying to control relationships. The ego thinks that relationships are built on trade and bargaining, and that doesn't seem to work very well. I don't really think love can be defined by anyone. I think it's something that has to be experienced, but certainly some of the attributes of it, gentleness and kindness, really unconditional love to me means really having no expectations on the other person, making no assumptions, and really totally accepting that person and giving that person that space for that person's own independence. Where my formal relationships were always based that I came first and they had to sort of fit into my mold. In fact, there's a wonderful cartoon on page 80 of the book. Maybe you can share that, Diane, you know, that one where the guy's shoving the
woman through the mold. It's a wonderful image of an average-sized woman and average width, sort of large with a long nose, sort of frizzy hair. And behind her is her spouse pushing her. And she's got her heels dug in with this terrified look on her face because he's trying to push her into this large wall with a mold in it of this 5'10" gorgeous woman. And up in the caption, there's a heart with wings on it. And the caption says, love flies away when we try and push others into our mold.
So I think many of us are just afraid of intimacy. Intimacy really means into me see. And we put so many fences around us because that we've all had painful experiences, and many of us keep those painful experiences alive and burning. So we can't really have a whole relationship if we're still tied into some unfinished business in the past. And that's one thing that we think is so important, to be able to work on one's unfinished business of the unhealed relationships. In our workshops, we find 75% of people, if we ask them, how many of you have relationships with your parents that aren't 100% healed? Whether it's in Japan, the United States, or Germany, it's about 75%.
Always, and it's never less.
Wow.
And I think one of the real important things to look at is that we think it's the relationships that are going awry now, but it's ultimately those ones way back when. And your question was, you know, why is it so difficult to love? You know, and how come it's so scary for most of us? I think it's scary, Tony, at least I found for myself, that when I was a child, there were things that happened that were really frightening. with, you know, I had my heart wide open, and many of us do, because we're very vulnerable and beautiful as children. And then as the world seems a little scarier, we close up our hearts and we start to move up into our heads.
Right.
And it feels safer because we realize that, you know, if I learn that 1 + 1 = 2 in the world and the world agrees with that, I can get along real well. And if I learn 2 + 2 = 4, and I can do extremely well. Well, you know, I learned 8 + 8 = 16, so I succeed at everything that I do. But you know, that doesn't just make you happy. You have to have more than that, because it's so many of us are very successful in the world because we've developed skills on creating environments around us that are well controlled and safe. But we have the illusion that if we think we can control people, we will be safe. And in reality, we can't, you know, and we won't be safe. So we're talking about taking that journey, the longest journey in the world, back out of the head and into the heart, so we can begin to use the intuitive forces that we have and use this wonderful brain of ours and our developed skills to facilitate whatever it is that we feel we need to do in the world. So it's integrating, once again, the mind and the heart.
It's sort of reminding us what the purpose of relationships for, and we have egos that thinks the purpose of relationships is to judge everyone to find out who's guilty and who's innocent. So it really produces a lot of separation. But the real purpose of relationship is for joining. And if we begin to discipline our minds to ask ourselves, you know, is this thought, is this action, are these words going to bring about joining, or are they going to bring about separation? I remember when I was raising my kids, I'd ask them, what do they do in school? And my kids are pretty normal. I said, well, same old thing, Dad, not much. And they sort of knew that that was a negative question. I wanted to find out what they did wrong so I could make them do it right, you see? And they knew it was an attack question. They knew it wasn't a very loving question.
So they didn't want to tell you very much at all. They didn't give me anything you could pick apart, huh?
Absolutely. And I think we need to really ask ourselves that kind of question. The questions we're asking loving, is it going to bring about joining? And it's a very important question. Another question is, do you want to be happy or do you want to be right?
Yeah, exactly.
Because we're making other people wrong and ourselves right. We're going to cause separation.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to be right or do you want to be in your love? Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people think that control and love are the same thing, and I think they discover emotionally that they're not, but they don't know how to change that. What do you tell somebody who has had these painful experiences and are allowing those experiences from the past to control them? How do they let go? Forgiveness, I assume, is a major part of it, but how? How do people do that?
Well, one of the things is to realize the reality of what's happening. Most people, most of our pain, in fact, all of our pain, has occurred at least from a minute ago until the time we were born. What people don't realize is that what they're experiencing now, they think is still happening, but it really happened back then, and they feel like a victim. Tony, because they can't go back and do anything about that. Someone gave us the definition of forgiveness once, and it was, forgiveness is giving up all hopes for a better past. I mean, it's not going to change.
No matter
how much grief you have over it. And the reality is that that experience, it's true, maybe at that time you were a victim and you couldn't do anything about it. But what remains now isn't that experience anymore or that person, but it's your thoughts and your attitudes and your judgments and your perceptions about that experience. And you know, it's your thoughts and your judgments and your attitudes and your perception, and you can do something about it because it's your mind. And if you change your mind, you really can change your life. So people really come to realize that, oh, wait a minute now, you mean that person who did that to me that was so horrible isn't still causing me pain? You're right, it's my thoughts. If I had amnesia for a moment, I wouldn't be in pain any longer. So we're not saying to forget it. Yeah. We're saying that now you know what you're dealing with, and you can do something about it.
Perhaps the first step, though, is not to try to love that person, because the ego's going to say that person's unlovable. We think the first step is to have peace of mind. Peace of God is your only goal. And then you can get in touch with the anger. A lot of people really are not in touch with the volcanic anger they may have around that. I think you really have to bring that up, experience it, and then decide, does that really bring you peace of mind? A lot of us enshrine that anger for a long time,
right,
and we really can't find peace of mind and justified anger at the same time. So part of that process is to recognize that you need to have peace of mind as your only goal, and recognize that the ego will never forgive that person. The key word is willingness.
Right.
We need to have the willingness to forgive and realize that we have a guide here in this heart of ours, a higher self, that really can take that anger and transform that into love when we have the willingness to live in the present and not be caught in the past, because we can't find peace of mind if we're caught in grievances and anger of the past.
People also feel really victimized by their own unforgiving thoughts, and one of the things we like to do is to have people talk about why they haven't forgiven somebody. And do you know that after 15 or 20 minutes we have to cut it off, because there are so many reasons why people don't forgive. But you know, primarily they don't want to let the person off the hook, or that if they forgive the person might then think that they agree with what they did.
Yeah, and they might do it again.
And they don't. Ah, the other is the fear that it'll happen to me again, right. If not by that person, by somebody else.
Right.
And so there's lots of these reasons, and when someone really gets in touch with that, then they can begin to deal with it. You know, one of the greatest underlying fears we have, and I think the underlying fear that permeates all of our problems, Tony, is the fear of separation from something or someone, whether it's a parent who has a child who's life-threatened, or someone in a relationship with someone that you love and they're in love with someone else, or if you've have a position, a job, and you've lost that, loss of lifestyle, or if you're addicted to drugs or alcohol, then indeed, you know, you're ostracized from society. The underlying fear of separation permeates every single problem we have without exception. So we're trying to have folks look at when they're really upset, whether it's about relationships or whatever, say, what is it that I'm afraid of being separated from, or who is it that I'm afraid of, and what is it that I'm attached to, and do I still want to continue to hold on to this attachment?
Those are great questions. One of the things that I teach people is that your experience of reality is based on what you focus on. And whatever you focus on continuously, you'll feel. In a room, you can be in a great room with great people, and if you focus on people fighting, then the meaning of that room is there's a fight. If you focus on people in love, you're in love. And that questions do control what we focus on. It's how we take control of our mind and allow our body, our emotions, our soul to really come out. One of the questions I have for you, though, is there are many philosophies, and I'm wondering if you agree or disagree with this. I think a lot of people believe the only way to transform something is to go back and re-experience it and reevaluate it. Is it possible, do you think, for someone to create a whole new meaning in something in a moment rather than having to go through long, laborious processes? In other words, I know my own personal belief is that it's never too late to have a happy childhood.
Right.
That part of the process is learning to find a new meaning, that some of the worst experiences in people's lives have sometimes turned out to be their best. Well, you'd never want to go back to them. That experience caused them to be sensitive today and has made them more loving today, or made them more gentle today, or a better parent today, or it altered their life's destiny, their entire path, because of that terrible event. So they wouldn't want it again, but when they see it in the light of a new meaning, oftentimes that seems to heal. So I'd be curious, do you agree that meanings can be transformed? And secondly, how do you really help people to change some of those meanings in a short period of time?
Well, Tony, I think you have to ask yourself the question, how long does it take to forgive?
Yes.
And we have an ego that says, well, I hear what you're saying, but I'm not ready yet.
Depends how motivated you are to forgive.
Maybe a week, maybe a month, maybe the rest of my life, or maybe even after that person's in hell. I don't know. And so we're very resistant to want to. But you know what? My answer to you is it only takes 1 second. You don't have to reanalyze all the kind of stuff. I think it's important to be aware of how you feel.
Yes.
And then decide.
Not suppress it in a moment.
Yeah, not to suppress it.
I agree.
And I think
agree.
A lot of people think they're supposed to suppress their anger or deny their anger. And I think we have to really honor that anger. But that doesn't mean we have to put it on another person.
Or wallow in it, for that matter.
Wallow in it. It doesn't mean the other person has to change. That we only have to change our own mind. Attitude and healing is based on the premise. It's not really people or conditions that cause us to be upset. It's only our own thoughts and attitudes toward people. And we can do something about that. That's the one thing we can do, is change the thoughts in our mind. That's what you're doing in your work. That's what we're doing in our work.
So behind all thoughts, I think behind every action, obviously, is a decision. Behind all decisions are beliefs. Beliefs help us to determine what things mean. And one of the most powerful things about both your works is that you are offering people core belief systems. And if we adopt a belief system, we evaluate things differently. Things mean something different, and therefore we feel different. We aren't stuffing. We're transforming meaning. So I'd be really curious, what are some of the most important beliefs that the two of you live by in your relationship, for example, that make your relationship such a great role model? I'd be curious.
Well, we start the day with a prayer. It's like putting the rudder in your sailboat. Most of my life, I didn't have a sailboat. It was rudderless, going all over the place. And that we want peace of mind as our only goal, peace of God, that's our only goal. It really sets your course for that day. That's one of the first things.
One of the first things. And I think we also try and keep in mind that a belief system that works for us might not work for someone else. And of all the work that we do, Tony, one of the things that we emphasize to every single one of our audiences, whether it's, you know, individually working with someone or as a group, is that nothing we're going to be talking about has to do with a form. In other words, there's no shoulds or shouldn'ts of what you should do in order to be happy per se. What we're talking about are choices.
Right.
And that, and however you choose to forgive, not forgive, is none of our business. it's your option. And if the way you're feeling today, you wake up tomorrow morning, doesn't work for you any longer, you'll know that you're not a victim, that you really can do something about it. So I feel that our work really is based on, and our work together individually as well as with others, is based on helping people open their minds to begin to see other ways of looking at what's going on in the world.
I agree.
I used to have relationships also that were built on a lot of withholds. I felt if I really would share my truth, then I'd be abandoned. And I'm not alone in that. A lot of people follow me.
See, I'm not fear of abandonment. If you try to ban me, I just follow you.
I think I'll put that even another way, Jerry, is one of the greatest fears people have is that if you really knew me, you could never possibly love me.
Yes, you hear that all the time.
Yeah. Yes, and yet intimacy, into me see, as you said before, is one of the things that we want the most and one of the things we push away. You know.
Another thing about a relationship that is different for me than other relationships is that it's an equal relationship.
Yes.
And that's a whole different thing because it used to be that I had my own chauvinistic kind of ways of dealing with things and things had to really be my way. And that's a whole different way of looking at it.
You know, we come from different generations and each of us have our own lessons to learn. And I think that we're strong teachers for each other. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that Jerry and I share is a deep willingness to really create an extremely equal relationship on every single level, and that's without exception. And when you come from old models, you're constantly challenged by that. And even after, 10 years, each day it comes up for us. But I think that we both have the willingness to really make that real for us.
So what is a relationship between you? How would you define that? What is your description of it? I'd be curious.
First of all, I would say that our primary relationship isn't with each other. Mm-hmm. That it's with this source which created us. We both have an equal commitment to service in the world, and we both share a common goal, which is wonderful, and that is peace of mind and peace of God, in whatever word. God is such a confined word, however someone wants to describe that. And our relationship is really based on supporting each other in every possible way. I really trust and respect Jerry's own personal guidance on how he's to live his life, and what he feels his daily intentions are and the work he wants to do. And I have spent my years now tearing up the scripts that I have for what I think that Jerry should or shouldn't be doing. Because I think as you come closer in relationship, you tend to say, oh yes, I know exactly what he'll do. We're constantly tearing it up, whether it's on the stage, whether it's during this interview, whether it's any day of our life, whether we're gardening or whatever. I want to give him all, I really don't want to give him space because it is his space. I don't want to interfere with his space. And I want to give every possible loving support. And I would say exactly the same thing in return. I think that you give what you receive in the world. And you have to be willing to, really go for a relationship with yourself if you expect to have it with another person. You have to have that integrity and honesty with yourself and be willing to have the courage to really look at your own pain, your own flaws, etc., and be willing to do something about it.
But we don't have a conflict-free relationship. We have our struggles and our challenges every day.
Most people are glad to hear that.
One of the things that...
What turns that around? What comes up and what turns it around?
What turns it around oftentimes is three words.
I love you.
Those three words are very helpful, but...
Those aren't the three.
That's not what you want to usually hear when you're in an argument or something.
Lots of times that word may not be appropriate.
This isn't about loving you.
That's not how you're feeling at that moment.
Okay. But I need your help.
But to say, please help me, Your Honor.
Please help me.
You said it.
Please help me.
Exactly,
it's amazing what that can do to the heart.
Yeah,
and if Diane's able to ask me that, then I can not see her as dumping on me, and I can listen. And she says, well, I feel like I want to be insane for a few minutes. I'm going to take responsibility for my thoughts. I know I'm not a victim, but here's how I feel.
That it seems to me like you're making me unhappy now. Now,
I know it's
only my perception, Jerry, but are you in a place where you can, help me and listen?
And if we're not in that place, we'll make an appointment to see each other an hour from now.
We do.
When you change state.
But we don't let that go. Well, that day somehow coming together and being able to discuss, and I think that's really very important.
And what that message really tells me too is that, okay, well, Jerry's really feeling insane at the moment, and if he didn't use that message, I would immediately want to get on my lawyer's cap and say, wait a minute, I have all my reasons why Jerry's totally misinformed here. I obviously didn't say it well enough or long enough or hard enough or loud enough or
he's
often enough.
He's not listening enough is what you're really thinking.
Right, and he didn't listen to me, right? And that was the old way of doing it, And of course, he's going to ultimately agree with me, know, because our minds are all insane. You know, we think everybody thinks the way we do. But this way, I know that in the end of it, what really Jerry really wants is not for me to agree with him. He wants me just to hear him. And then I know at the end of that, he'll be calm enough to hear me. And you know, invariably at the end of the listening period, my perception and his has always been altered because you really have listened. It's very difficult to listen.
You know, writing a book together is an interesting experience.
Well, I like that smile when you say the word interesting.
Well, look at the Carters. They almost got divorced.
That's right. That's right.
And one of the things in writing a book, as you well know, that it's very easy to become attached to what you wrote. That's your own creation.
That's right.
You just
like
wrote
it's like one of your children, you know?
I just wrote the best thing in the world, you know, and I thought, oh, this is so profound, and I take it over to Jerry, and he goes, I don't get this, Doc. I mean, there you've got your challenges.
And it was very interesting. We did an outline on the book together, and we signed each other different chapters, and then we had this interaction. But what's there now, we don't know who restarted that chapter. It's so interacted, and it really brought us closer together.
That's neat. I think one of the most powerful, at least for me, beliefs that I pulled out of A Course in Miracles is the belief that however somebody responds to you, no matter what it looks like, that all responses are either a loving response or a cry for help. And that's really changed my life and how I perceive people. It doesn't matter what it is, whether they're, you know, angry at somebody or they're ill or whether they've cheated on their husband or wife or whatever the case may be, I look at it from that perspective. So that belief has really affected my life, my ability to not be judgmental. I still do it, but not be as judgmental and be more connected to people and love people more. So I'd like to know, from your perspective, why is that belief so important? How can it really change our life? And how has it affected you?
Well, I probably was one of those provocative persons you'd ever want to meet most of my life. And I thought I was here to judge people, really. And that's why I was a psychiatrist. I could put people in categories and tell you who's neurotic, who's psychotic. Not realizing, you know, I had my own insanity, too.
Yeah.
And I often thought if I could rewrite the nomenclature for the American Psychiatric Association, it would just be one page, one line says that we're insane if we're not experiencing ourselves as love and giving that love away. So why that particular statement is so important, that it's possible to see only two emotions in the world, love and fear, that people are either loving or that they're fearful of giving us a call of help for love. If we just look at our eyes and ears, it sure looks like those people are attacking us.
Right.
And if we're just going to pay attention to what our eyes and ears say, we're going to be in trouble because our ego will attack and defense and we'll go in that round and round circle doing that.
And we'll respond to a cry for help with our own cry for help. Mm-hmm.
So we'll see justification of attacking back. But if a person, if I'm yelling at you right now, and rather than you're feeling you're a victim, if you could see that I was very fearful right now, if you chose to see me as fearful, your heart could open to me, or vice versa.
Right.
And that's the secret, to be able to perceive that that person is fearful, giving a call of help for love. That allows our heart to open and allows us to reach out, because that's what it's all about. I think our purpose here in life, for me at least, is that we're here one second at a time to love, to forgive, and to be of service, to help other people.
So how do we help someone to forgive who doesn't feel like forgiving? How do you teach someone who has got so much hatred and anger inside in that moment how to really let go?
Well, let me just give you one example. In the book, One Person Can Make a Difference, in the first chapter is a story about Zelinda. Now here's a woman whose 19-year-old son was murdered 10 years ago, and she wanted to keep the guy in jail who did this for the rest of his life. He kept coming up for parole. She found that her main object in life was to keep vengeance and hate going. That was really her main object.
Right.
Her hair was falling out, she had skin disease, and she read Love is Letting Go Fear a few years ago and then became a student of the Course and began listening to a linear voice saying, hey, there's another way of doing this. To have peace of mind is another way of doing it. And she began listening to her heart, tell her what to do, said to visit the man who murdered. She didn't want to, but she did. And after she began seeing him for a long time, she began seeing this guy differently. And did an amazing thing, helped him get out of jail.
Wow.
Amazing. She now
what a healing experience.
She now left Idaho. She's back at our center working with us. She has a healed experience. Now, she lives in a community where people think, well, this is crazy. You know, you don't forgive. There's some people do things that you don't forgive about. That's what our egos would say.
Right.
What Diane and I would say is that we'll never find peace until we can not exclude anyone from our love. We have to see everyone as our spiritual twin.
I think there was a wonderful story, Jerry, on your first trip to Australia, when I wasn't with you, about the man who was interviewing you on the radio. It's a perfect example of seeing someone as fearful or loving, and you might want to share that story.
Well, not to me. If you've been on a radio, I'm sure everyone loves your book. Maybe you come along with someone
who doesn't. Well, not everybody loves me.
maybe you see someone who doesn't. Well, anyway, I was on nationwide Australian radio, and this guy didn't like Love Is Letting Go Fear at all, and he kept putting his knife out there, and it's doing this, and my old lawyer trip wanted to come out, and then I all of a sudden said, why don't you do what you write in your book, you know?
What a concept.
See, the guy is fearful. So I started seeing the guy as fearful. I didn't understand why he was fearful, and I said, I'm just going to send him love and peace. He may not change. He didn't change. But I left feeling a lot more peaceful than when I started that interview.
Yeah.
The next night, I was lecturing 3,000 people at Town Hall. He was in the front row. Why was the guy in the front row when he didn't like anything I said? And then the next day, I got a phone call from him saying, he had some problems. Could he come to see me? And his voice is very gentle. And we spent 3 hours with each other, and he left really healed. And what came about was that most of the people in his life always created another anger against him. I was the only one that he ever met that he could trust, because I didn't get angry back. I saw that he was fearful.
Yeah.
So really, in my own defenselessness, my safety lies. That's one of the affirmations that we find very, very helpful, seeing just people as loving or that they're fearful, not seeing them as attacking us.
There's a wonderful cartoon in Love Is Letting Go of Fear also that is, you see a man standing there with a lampshade over his head. He says, I can choose to see someone's light instead of their lampshade. And when we talk about giving someone's either loving or giving a call of help for love, it doesn't mean that, oh, they're giving a call of help for love, I have to jump in there and save them or do anything. What it does is it gets rid of our need and desire to attack back. And then we can go inside and say, what do I need to think, say, and do in a harmonious way to respond to this situation?
I think that's really important, because I think a lot of people think that they have to resolve something in the moment, or they have to turn somebody's view around in the moment, and out of that, they end up pushing really hard, and they don't give people what they really want, which is a sense that they're heard, or a sense that they're loved, or a sense that they're connected with. And I think what's beautiful is that you're really practicing what you preach, and it's one of the reasons I wanted to meet with you guys, because I've heard so much about you, and you are what I would call congruent. You walk your talk, and I know you make mistakes.
But we're not trying to change people.
Exactly. So you're not trying to change people. You're offering people tools.
We're not trying to tell this other person they should forgive this person.
Right.
Our job is that we teach what we want to learn.
We're still learning.
We're the head of the remedial students class. We tell everybody, this is why we're here. Don't you know that we're still trying to get this
We're trying to give ourselves a wake-up call.
That's nice.
Opening a door, and whether the person wants to go through the door or not, that's their decision, but everything's a choice. What we're really trying to say, everything's a choice in this world.
Yeah. Or what a message.
That gives us freedom. That what gives us freedom.
And what's real important for us is that we don't have any kind of a measuring stick as to what someone's outcome of their choices are. Because what happens then, like a therapist or a social worker who's working with someone that they're trying to help, you have the goal of changing the person, as wonderful and as altruistic and as loving as that is, they're going to become your enemy, and you're going to wind up hating them if they don't do what you want. It's like a doctor working with someone who's life-threatened. If that patient gets close to dying and they go ahead and die, you're going to feel like you lost. So we take that whole idea of success a little bit differently, that we know that it's our role here to give everything we possibly can when it's appropriate, but to detach from the results of a person's choices and to respect and honor a person's journey.
Well, everybody has their own time as well. And I think a lot of times people think that everyone has to be in fall when they have some winters and springs to go through yet.
Right.
And it's like they go to the soil and they plant the seed and come back the next day and go, where's the plant? And the soil says, are you new? You know, we've been here before.
And the issue is that they need something to grow there, but not that this person needs to grow at the moment.
That's a good point.
So we're constantly, tearing up our scripts for others too. And it's a real important message. And I think the whole idea of the Course in Miracles, which really are these incredibly beautiful books, but it's not an organization, it's not a religion, you can't donate to it, you can't organize it, you can't join it. They're books for personal transformation that people from religions all over the world, all different cultures, use to help and assist them to find a deeper meaning in their life.
Many people are enhanced by going back to their own religion, where they might have gone away from that. I think one of the things we need to learn if we want to find peace of mind also is how to forgive our own religious training. I think lots of times that holds us in a bind, and we're very angry about what might have happened back there in our own religious training, might have been disappointed.
Well, we may have linked something to our religion that had nothing to do with it. I remember reading in one of your books about the experience that I think it was you were in high school and you lost a very close friend in a car accident. And then from that point on, you're like, how could God do this to me? How could God be so unfair? How do you help someone who has a belief like, you know, God is unfair, look at what's happening, the meaning they take from an experience is this is a totally unfair experience. What would you offer someone like that philosophically with helping to find a new meaning?
I would accept their feeling immediately. I wouldn't want to change their feeling,
right.
But I would ask them, are there other ways you might want to look at it? Are you willing to look at your values differently?
So you don't tell them, you ask them, which is the real key. You allow them to come up with the solutions.
We're not really there to change that person. Again, we want to open that door. And many people are willing to say, well, I'm really tired of looking at this way. Certainly going into silence, getting away from the business. One of the things Diane and I like doing in the morning, we take the Course in Miracles and we read it. And we spend 20 minutes in meditation each morning, and we go on a long walk, and a meditation walk. We think it's really important to get away from that business of the world, because when you get caught in that business, it's very easy to think you're there to achieve, to do other things. We don't realize that the most important thing we can do is to love and to care and help other people.
I agree.
People often say that, you know, I don't have the time to take a couple of minutes in the morning or 20 minutes or whatever. You know, our lives are all so busy, and I don't know about you, but I have a habit of just filling mine up with so much. There's certain days, or at least in the past, there were days where I couldn't possibly get it all, you know, crammed in. And our dear friends Hugh and Gail Prather, the authors of, you know, Notes to Each Other and Notes to Myself, really taught us a good lesson. They said that they were trying to have a spiritual practice in the morning that they took, you know, 10, 20, even maybe 30 minutes each day just for themselves. And you're talking about loving yourself, right? The last one on the list to give love or forgiveness to is always ourselves. And so they said that they wanted to give it a new priority, and they decided to give that special time each morning the same priority that they give to diarrhea.
Oh, no.
Well, but now, Tony,
one way of putting it where you'll never forget.
I want you to think about it for a minute. I want to think about it for a second, because when do you ever not give diarrhea total priority? I don't care who you're making a presentation to. I don't care if you're standing at the altar getting married. We always say, I haven't got a few minutes just to get grounded, to get quiet, to go to place, but diarrhea...
Maybe we can take the urgency from that and associate it, but not any of the other associations.
Right, right. But so the reality, let's get down to the reality, is it that we don't have the time,
well, we always have time,
we don't make the time, right?
Make it most
so let's just be honest with ourselves. You know, I'm not giving myself this little bit of time as a major priority to love myself. And so that's really helped us a lot.
That's great. You guys both talk a lot about retraining the mind. What are some of the strategies you've developed for retraining your own minds and really conditioning yourselves to operate from the attitudes that really enhance the quality of life and give meaning to life versus the attitudes that are destructive and tear down what's really valuable in your lives?
Well, certainly it's recognizing that I'm not a victim of the world. So often I felt I was a victim. It's really getting rid of blame and guilt, not seeing value in guilt and blame anymore.
Right.
It means not interpreting people's behavior. It means taking all these measuring sticks I've used about myself and other people and burying them and not using them. But really seeing there's a choice of whether I'm going to experience love or fear. That's really a choice. Choice whether I'm going to experience peace or conflict. I'm not going to give my power away to someone else to decide how I'm going to feel. I didn't really decide that myself. It's a choice whether I'm going to be a love finder or fault finder, love giver or love seeker. And if I really recognize what my purpose here is to teach only love, that kind of mind training, I think, becomes very significant as we begin to discipline ourselves each day. Sure, we make mistakes, but we can fall down and pick ourselves up again. And when we're going in that direction, what happens is we begin to find that inner peace inside, and then the world we see then becomes different.
So you become your message instead of just speaking it.
Yeah, I do think that what we see out there is really dependent on our thoughts. What we believe is what we see. And so we need to look back at some of those belief systems we've had and some of the values we've held on and take a whole new look at those things and see which ones really help. Certainly most of my life, I thought guilt was a very important thing to hold on to. And I realized the first step in letting go of that is not to see value in guilt. As a matter of fact, the attraction of guilt really produces the fear of love. And this is one of the problems around love, is that we're so attracted to guilt. We don't feel ourselves lovable or connected with each other or with our source. And this is the problem that many of us have.
I'll add on a few things to that, and I think when we talk about guilt, people get confused where they say, well, wait a minute, you're talking about my morals, my values, or what I believe in, because we're talking about guilt, which is a manipulative tool to try and control another person or ourselves. And the only reason we hold on to guilt, which is a belief system.
I agree.
It's not like the tooth fairy comes along and drops a belief system on you in the middle of the night. You've chosen to accept this belief system for one reason or another. And that we hold on to it because somewhere it serves us. Somewhere there's value in it. And people get extremely shocked when they realize that, wait a minute, I've been feeling this guilt all these years. You mean that I'm choosing to hold on to it? Yes, you are. And there's a reason. So when they can finally no longer see value in it, they're able to really let go of it, stop playing the game of guilt. And it's usually someone they're playing with wants to keep playing like a tug of war.
Right.
But if you drop one in, that person has a choice too. They can either drop it also, or they can go out and find someone else to play with. Two other areas I wanted to add to what you said before, Jerry. One of the things that's helped me as a businesswoman now is to, instead of having conflicting goals, is to set just one goal. And that goal now is peace of mind, peace of God every day. And every other goal that I used to have now becomes my intention.
Right.
And with it being an intention, it means that I'm no longer attached to the result of the ultimate outcome.
Better goals many times.
Totally.
Better results, yeah.
Of course, because I'm no longer living in the ultimate outcome and missing the everyday experience of living. And the other category I think that we really focus on each day to try and, you know, live these principles is to really look at the nature of reality and what is real. And, you know, in my mind, in my experience, the only thing that's real is that which doesn't change. The only thing I found that doesn't change is whatever this loving force is that created us. Because everything else is going to change. This room's going to change, you're going to change, I'm going to change. Everything is in constant change. So minimally, it's perceptual. So as I see the world, Tony, and you see it, and Jerry sees it, and our listeners and viewers see it, that it's really minimally a perception, which is also really kind of distorted by my past experiences. And I have these lenses on this camera of my mind, which have all different filters on them.
Each day you're stacking more filters.
Totally. Now, I would say all the loving experiences I have and all the healed relationships I've worked on in my life are clear filters, really. They're not going to block or distort anything. But all the unhealed ones and the negative experiences that I've had that I haven't dealt with yet are going to have a distortion. So when I look at you, I'm not really seeing you. I'm sort of seeing you, but what I'm doing is projecting out my past experiences, and what's happening is it's reflecting back to me. So perception is a mirror, not a fact. And so it helps me to remember that everything I'm looking at in the world is really filtered through the screen of my experience. And there's no other person that sees it that way. And so we're trying to really learn, not trying, we actually are living each day and working hard at it, to see each person's degree of perception as totally relevant and meaningful as our own, even though we might not understand it. And maybe they're at 180 degrees in direct opposition to us.
That's how we have a full spectrum of life, though,
we
is having
do.
So many different perceptions
right.
out there.
But I don't have to make them wrong in order to make me right. I just know that they're different.
And another thing that we find is important in retraining the mind is really asking people to focus on their purpose in life. What is it? One way of asking that question is, if this is going to be your last day on earth, and you're going to die at midnight, and someone is going to write one sentence about you, what would you want them to say? And we ask this to businessmen oftentimes, and it's very interesting. They don't say they wanted to have more companies or be on more board of directors or have had more money.
Or that they should have worked harder.
Yeah. What they say is they'd like to be remembered about how much they cared, how much they loved, how much they really helped other people. And a lot of them found what they wrote down was not in harmony with how they lived
every
life.
Single day of their life.
And
right.
So all of a sudden, there's some homework there to change that priority.
That's right.
Because I think we really have to each day focus on really what our purpose is.
I agree.
And we live in such an achievement, me-first-oriented kind of society that it really becomes very important to really begin to say, isn't it more valuable to have the same interests in the other person as we do ourselves?
And I think also you find people out there who aren't achieving just for themselves, but they're still putting achievement so they can finally give to someone else. I know I was guilty of that. My thing was, I'll achieve and do all these things, contribute and make a difference, and then eventually I can be happy. And one day I made the reverse. I thought, you know, what if I happily achieved and made a difference? Mm-hmm. Maybe I make a bigger difference than I did before.
So what made you reverse that?
Was looking at first as pain, seeing that it didn't work, that I was helping everybody else, but I wasn't feeling the way I wanted inside. And then second was just looking at what my values were and realizing that that belief that I had to do everything for the rest of the world before I gave to me actually caused me to give less. even though I didn't want to believe that, I one day finally got clear that was true. But I think that I have to agree with you 100%. Everything I'm about is teaching people to get clear about their purpose and their values and live within those values on an ongoing basis so they have a sense of meaning. And one of the challenges, I think, is that most people look at negative emotions, what they call negative, as something that's attacking them, and they do one of two things, either suppress them or try to avoid them, which never works, or they wallow in them or compete with people. You think you're bad? Let me tell you my story. You know, I'll tell you what really bad is. I'll show you what it is. And what I think is that all emotions have their place, including fear, including resentment. But I think what they're doing is they're giving us a call to action that we've got to change something right now. Either we have to change our perceptions or we have to change our actions. So in your mind, I'd be curious, why do we have fear?
Well, Toyon, I think our ego has created fear.
Okay.
And I think the moment we ever felt separated, whenever that happened from that source, that's when fear began. When fear began, all of a sudden, we became attached to these bodies that were moving in linear time, and we believe that when you die, that's the end of the line. And I think much of our fear, as Diane was saying earlier, has to do with our feelings of separation. When I think one of the things, if we're going to find that peace of mind, is to find another way of looking at death, another way of looking at life. And my life has been really fulfilled very much at our Center of Attunement, because we see so many children who are facing life-threatening illnesses, and many children with AIDS. And they've taught us so much about other ways of looking at the world. There's a kid we saw in Atlanta, Georgia, for example, who had come close to dying with sickle cell anemia many, many times. And we asked him, what was it like to be that close to dying and living? You remember that story, Diane?
And he said, I think that life is like a giant library, that when you're born, the library belongs to God, and when you're born, your parents come and they take you out. He said, and you know how some books have a long due date and some books have a short due date? And when your date is due, you just go back home to the library of God where you never really left in the first place, and then you're at one with all souls. But when you're out there, you know, you're learning how you learn from a book. And
right.
He really had it all in perspective. And this young man, Kerry, is now in graduate school and wanting to become a pediatrician because he really knows that giving and receiving are the same. And as he has learned to go out and help another person, he's learned to help himself, and he really wants to find a way to give back.
That's wonderful.
And the reason he didn't feel fear, because he felt this interconnection with his source. He says, if you really feel always one with God, then there's nothing to fear. And he really didn't fear death. It's not that he wanted to die, but he didn't fear it, because he always knew that life is really eternal, that love is eternal, and that death is just like laying your body aside. That was his belief.
I think that the whole idea of staying connected is what heals people most. And I remember, again, hearing a story that you talked about where I think it was a woman who had massive pain, physical pain. I think she was suffering from cancer. And I believe you had her look around the room and just love everyone, not expecting anything back, not for any reason. And you weren't going to ask her questions. Did she do it right? Maybe you can allude to a little bit about that
story.
Well,
it was a situation where this woman had metastatic cancer and she wanted to get rid of her pain. And I said, well, how about wanting peace of mind? Would you be willing to have peace of mind for a second? He said, well, yeah, I haven't experienced that in years. And I said, well, would you be willing just for 1 second, just to look around the room with everyone here, and just be concentrated and just give them love. Just have your heart, just send love hearts. And having everyone else in the room do the same to her. About to evaluate, because once you start to evaluate love, it disappears. You know how many couples get together, who gives the most, who doesn't give the most by the measurement. And a fascinating thing happened. At the end of the session, she said, I just got to tell everyone, not only did my pain go away, but I felt peace in a way that I never felt before. She was concentrating not on her body or what happened to her yesterday or what might happen to her tomorrow. She was concentrating on this one moment of giving her heart to other people. That is the magic. In fact, remember the definition of a miracle.
Right. A miracle is a shift in perception that removes the blocks to the awareness of love's presence in our life.
Oh, that's beautiful.
So it's getting rid of the blocks, and that's what she did then.
That's nice. Well, let's talk a little bit more about physical healing then. We worked with Norman Cousins, and we talked quite a bit about his work and how we can really heal our bodies, starting with our minds, starting with our hearts. You've had quite an incredible background of experience. Tell me, what are the attitudes that really seem to heal, that seem to make the difference physically in us, and how does that work from your perspective?
Well, let's be clear. At our center, we redefine healing differently. We say, health is inner peace. That's what healing is all about.
Yes.
It's inner peace. And healing is learning to let go of fear. So our position is not trying to help people change their bodies. That oftentimes happens when this happens. But our real focus is helping people let go of fear and to bring about peace of mind. And many miracles sometimes happen along that line. And it's fascinating when people are in a self-help group and they're helping each other. how much peace they feel in a way that they never felt before, because they know they're not alone, and they know they're in a consciousness of giving. When you have positive mental pictures in your mind, this affects the immune system.
Yes.
When you let go of fear and have love in your body, this affects the immune system. So we're finally getting documentation of this, which is really exciting.
We tend to get whatever we focus on, including our physical body. So when we focus on our fear, we start to head for that wall, including disease. You had, when we talked earlier, Diane, a great phrase about...
Right, I had heard it from Robert Bly, and it says that the body weeps the tears the eyes never shed. And I think we can really identify with that. So many of us hold and harbor so many things inside of our bodies that haven't yet come to the surface, our emotional surface of our minds.
I'm just thinking out loud about an experience we had. There's a woman named Sharon Winter who was just like a daughter to me. She had lymphoma, and she died when she was around 22, and she stayed in our house many times and became very close to my sons. And my youngest son, Lee, was having a party for his getting his PhD in psychology. She wanted to come to the party. Now, she was in the hospital, really dying. I saw her that morning, and she's on IV drip from morphine, and she said, well, I'm going to try to get the party. And I didn't know she'd make it the rest of that day. Party was at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock. She shows up with her mother with makeup on and stood up for 3 hours. No one ever knew that she was sick. The next day I saw her in the hospital. She was back there again, and she died about a couple of weeks later. But, you know, when the mind is determined, it doesn't pay any attention to your blood chemistry or what's going on. The mind really controls the body. This is what we really need to understand. It's not the body that controls the mind.
So if there's someone that you know that's needing physical healing and you really love them and care about them, and you're a doctor, what is the doctor's number one priority in helping a patient to heal in your mind?
The number one priority, is no question about it, is to not see that person as guilty, to be given total acceptance, total love, and forgiveness. I think that's our primary function in the relationship for that person who comes in with whatever symptom that they have. Not to see the shadow of the past that most people carry on within themselves.
Right.
That's the biggest gift we can give another person, is our own peace of mind, our own unconditional love. I think that's the biggest gift we can give another person.
I remember when you were in medical school, or shortly after, maybe you went to Korea, I think it was, you talked about how you noticed that in medical school, a lot of the students began to come down with the very diseases that you guys were studying, like a third of the class.
Very, very suggestible. You know what you're talking about? Tuberculosis or syphilis, whatever you have,
right.
Certain numbers of the class would have it, because the mind's very suggestible, very suggestible.
But also, at that same time, you had a great deal of fear of tuberculosis yourself.
Yes,
and you had an experience that probably taught you for a lifetime not to fear.
I forgot about that. But I was in Boston, an intern, and I was very afraid I was going to die of tuberculosis, and I had to be on the tuberculosis. My one thing I thought, I wanted to take a deep breath, don't breathe for a whole month, you know, because I was afraid I was going to die.
So they put you on the ward. You're, whatever you resist persists, huh?
So what happened was, I guess it was the third day I was there in the middle of the night, I was called to see this woman who was an alcoholic and had esophageal varices, and she vomited blood, and she was almost pulseless, and the oxygen machine wouldn't work, and I was giving mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and working on her, and she started to breathe, and everything worked out okay, and I went back to my quarters, and my clothes was bloody, and I remember I wasn't scared once during that time. And I looked back at that and said, well, I was only in a consciousness of giving. When I was concerned about what was going to happen to me in the future or what might happen to me in the past, and it was a wonderful learning experience for me that I don't have fear if I'm totally focused on helping another person. And I let go of my absorption and identity with my body and think of in the abstraction of love, this is what it's all about.
There's a wonderful expression that says, as you reach your hand out into the darkness to help another's hand back into the light, you discover that it's your own.
Oh, that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. If you want a helping hand, look at the end of your arm. Huh? That's nice. I remember reading in, I think it was Teach Only Love, you told a story that really touched me when you cry. It was about a gentleman who was really, his body was racked and withered, and he'd been through some major physical traumas, and you're going in there to give him the physical help he needed, but you discovered that maybe he needed another level of help. Maybe you could share that story.
I'm aware that when I ask the little inner voice what it is I'm supposed to do and take it out of the technique aspect, and I'm just there holding another person's hand and giving him the dignity of love, that there's something that happens in that room. It's almost like electricity goes on. And a shift takes place in that person's perception, that it has much more to do with love than it has to do with medication.
Yeah.
And I didn't learn that in medical school, because in medical school we didn't talk about love. That's not a word that was used. We didn't talk about humility. They tend to treat doctors as to being godlike kind of people, and I find that when I see everyone as my teacher, that changes the whole aspect of the communication, because I think love can't be experienced unless it's on an equal basis. It's not done vertically, it has to be equal.
Connected, interesting. Somebody said, gosh, there's so much good stuff here. How do I get my hands around it? Well, one thing we want to do is get your books, there's no doubt, and hopefully contact you at the center. But right now, what would be a set of lessons or a set of actions that people could take over the next 7 days, that if they're feeling a little frustrated right now, or feeling a little separate, or feeling a little alone, or feeling a little overwhelmed, or even a little ill, what would be a couple of beliefs or actions that they could take that you think might make a difference for them?
Well, before we begin, maybe just a simple statement that our ego is going to want to say, well, it can't be that simple. No. And I'd like to remind your listeners that simplicity is very difficult for a confused mind to understand. And it's really important to kind of keep it simple.
And that's great.
When you keep it simple, it really kind of works.
Yeah, I agree.
So I would say to start the day, for sure, wanting peace of mind as your only goal.
Now define that for a second, because a lot of people hear peace of mind, they say, peace of mind, you know.
Peace of mind is not having conflict, not having this battle of all these thoughts going this way and that way, and anger here, and what should I do next? It means really feeling a sense of love and interconnectedness with all the universe.
So if you're at peace of mind, what you really are is you're looking at how to share and give love throughout your day, and therefore you experience it?
It's like feeling like you're in a beautiful lake, a clear lake in nature. It means really feeling a sense of oneness, a balance.
Yes.
No thoughts are disturbing you, and you just feel yourself consumed and breathing in and breathing out love.
And I think during those few moments on the waking of the day, and we're talking about before you even get out of bed, to also do perhaps a little exercise about forgiving yourself as well as someone else. So what I'll often do, and Jerry will do, is to bring in my mind someone who I have a conflict with or maybe an unhealed relationship with, see that person surrounded in light, and say to that person, you know, I release you, I forgive you, I forgive myself, and I thank you for the gift that you've come here to teach me. And then that person gets smaller and smaller in my mind, and the light gets brighter and brighter. And then in that same light, I see an image of myself. And that image becomes the personality self, Diane, and this is the spirit self speaking. And we have a conversation, and each morning now, and this really changed my life, Tony, each morning she says to me, Diane, do you forgive me? It's just a blanket thing, not even specifically, Diane, do you forgive me? And I say to her, Diane, I forgive you for all your misperceptions. You are a loving person. You know, you're not only deserving of receiving love, but you're very capable of giving it, and I love you. And then we literally embrace in my mind and come together, mind, body, spirit, that day as a whole person. That has been the most healing exercise because, Tony, one of the biggest questions and most frequently asked ones is, how do I forgive myself? And one of the other things people can do is take a little picture of themselves, put it by the mirror in the morning when they're going to look in it, and shave or, you know, comb their hair or whatever, and give love to that image, especially one maybe of a child when they were really in a lot of pain.
Interesting. So if someone starts their day by centering and just really being in a place where they love themselves and they're willing to love their environment and they're looking for what's great and what's lovable versus looking for what's wrong,
right,
that starts the day.
As well as having gratitude. There's a wonderful expression from the Course that says, love is the way I walk in gratitude. And so that I think that the love that we want to receive in our lives, we're able to give that day when we have gratitude. I always feel that also when you're trying to heal a relationship with someone in that exercise in the morning, pray that they get exactly what you want for yourself.
That's nice.
All you got to do.
That's nice. So
another important statement I think would be, forgiveness is the key to happiness. That everyone that comes into our lives is a teacher of forgiveness. And reminding ourselves that if we are holding on to unforgiving thoughts, it's really a decision to suffer. Mm-hmm. And we have to ask ourselves, do you still want to suffer? Do I still want to suffer? And we look at that again and see, am I willing to really let go of those grievances? Am I willing to start the slate clean today?
Yeah. And asking that daily.
Right.
Not just once in a while.
Daily.
The more you measure something, the better off you are. If you check in once a year, you're going to have a bad year.
Right. I think one of the things that can be done each day is to remember once again, even if you have to write it out on a card and put it up on the refrigerator, that, which is also the definition of attitudinal healing, it's not people or experiences or events out there in the world that make me upset. It's my own thoughts and attitudes and judgments and perceptions about those people and events that really cause me distress. primary thing to remember, that I am not a victim of the world, and also that I'm probably not upset for the reasons I think. That's a real helpful one, right? You know, there's a wonderful 18-day mini course in healing relationships to give us to receive that Jerry created from the course years ago, and it's in many languages now. It's in Chinese, etc., French, German, etc. It's available through our center.
Fantastic. Give me two more tips. What are two more things that people can do
going through the day with the intention of not blaming other people or condemning ourselves? Going through the day with the intention of not judging other people.
Well, you have a great phrase in one of your books where you say, it's the guy that's the biggest jerk is the one who needs the most love. I know I'm paraphrasing, but that's in essence what you say.
That's close.
Can you clarify that?
Well, you know, who can raise their hand and say, I've never been a jerk?
That's right, I agree with you.
So, we're, as Diane said earlier, you know, the perception is that we see ourselves as a mirror. So we really loving ourselves and letting go of that jerk part of ourselves, really. I think the biggest joy that can come in our lives is the decision to be helpful to another person. So we need to ask ourselves, how can we be helpful to another person? How can we bring on a smile? Right. In my letters, I put little red hearts, and one story was, I sent this to a person who had written me about liking one of my books, and he opened the letter, and he was on an elevator, and he just had broken up with his girlfriend. And all these hearts fell on the floor, and all these people in the elevator were helping him pick up the hearts, and it just made him feel so good.
Oh, that's so great.
So it felt me feel good, because in that one small way, if your listeners could find someone they wouldn't want to phone, that they haven't talked to in 3 months, just to call them and say how much they cared, how much they loved them, that would do much to bring about self-healing.
And I would say, Tony, in closing that, in order to really have inner peace, and in order to be a truly successful person on the inside and the outside, we need to have the courage to have a true harmony in what we think, what we say, and what we do every moment of the day. And whenever we find ourselves out of whack or upset and are wondering why, ask ourselves the question, what is it that's not happening? Am I thinking one way and speaking and doing another? And it's bringing those three into harmony that gives us a truly honest, loving, and successful life.
I couldn't agree with you more. Let me ask you two last questions if I can. One of those is, what's the single most important lesson that you've learned in your life thus far? We probably covered some of them, but how would you define it? I'd like to hear from each of you, maybe starting with you, Diane. I like asking simple questions.
Right, it's a wonderful question. The one that comes to my mind really is that love is the way that I can walk in gratitude in my life. For now to be able to look back on every single experience, all the ones that I used to think were negative ones, and truly, yes, they weren't ones I would, you know, redesign again. But I've learned to really not only understand them, but to accept them, embrace them as part of myself, and to say, now, this is the fruit of who I am. This is the fiber of who I am in the world. And to know that every single thing is a positive lesson that I can learn from.
Feeling gratitude even for the toughest times.
And gratitude for all those people that were my tough teachers, too. Every single one of them has been a wonderful gift.
That's great. How about for you, Jerry?
For me, it's forgiveness. The powerful lesson of forgiveness allows me to remember my interconnectedness with God, my source, and to feel a sense of oneness with everyone. Maybe I can end with a story that I just heard yesterday, and it was more of a story that someone was telling us about a family that had a baby and a three-year-old daughter. And the three-year-old daughter wanted to go in this room to be alone with the baby. And they're a little concerned because they're really focused on doing that. But
right.
they had one of these machines that they could hear everything went on.
Right.
So they allowed her to do this. And what they heard the three-year-old say to the baby, he says, remind me about what God is. I'm beginning to forget. And that was so powerful to me, because I believe this is what our life's all about. And every time that I remind myself around the principles we were talking about retraining our mind, to remind ourselves we're not here to attack other people, we're not here to interpret other people. We're really here to love and forgive and help others, that I can really remember that I'm really part of this whole process of the universe, that I'm part of creation, and that I can remember God. So I want to be like that three-year-old who's learning from the baby who we really are, because they're the wonderful, most wonderful teachers of unconditional love, because they don't judge their parents about whether they're too tall or too short.
The parents on the other side are, however.
They love you just as you are. You know, that's what babies are all about. I always like to remind myself, okay, well, I want to keep that innocent child in me alive.
That's nice. I think it was Socrates who said, learning is remembering. Mm-hmm. You know, what we're really here to do is just remember what life really is and who we really
Absolutely.
Are. That's nice. How do you guys want to be remembered?
I don't think I necessarily need to be remembered as a person, but the experience of love that I had here, I know will be remembered.
That's nice.
I don't think it's necessary for me to be remembered either. I just the whole aspect of love is an eternal aspect. I think we're to know that I'm always interconnected with everyone, and so I don't need anything after I'm gone. That's not what it's all about, because I feel there's a heart connection that's always there.
Love always extends and expands and continues, and it never ends with death.
It's an exciting time to be alive, too.
It sure is. It sure is. Well, I appreciate the privilege of your presence and getting a chance to know you guys and become friends with you. I hope that people will take advantage of the opportunity to find out more of what you have to share, because it's a limited realm, video or audio, and you certainly have a lot more to share with people, and you've already helped millions by living your message, not just talking about it, and I appreciate that very much.
It's a pleasure being here with you. Appreciate your questions.
Thank you, Tony.
And your humor.
We might also mention, Tony, that there's, I think, 65 centers now around the world,
Fantastic.
And they're all independent centers, and all the services are free and always have been. So people can call our main center and find out about it.
I'd also like to show people your book, because I think they'd probably love to get this also. It's called One Person Can Make a Difference, Ordinary People Doing Extraordinary Things. And I certainly hope people go out and get those. You certainly have shared with people, as you said, not the need that they have to change, but certainly a great deal of tools, beliefs, values, and attitudes that can make the difference in their ability to make change happen more quickly if they're willing. And hopefully a lot of people listening here are quite willing. I think they are. So thank you very much, and God bless you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tony.